Carlos Castaneda's Tales of Power, Part 3, The Sorcerer's Explanation, Chapter 1, Three Witnesses to the Nawal. Upon returning home, I was faced again with the task of organizing my field notes. When Don Juan and Don Janeiro had made me experience became all the more poignant as I recapitulated the events. I noticed, however, that my usual reaction of indulging for months in bewilderment and awe over what I had gone through was not as intense as it had been in the past. Various times I deliberately attempted to engage my feelings, as I had done before, in speculation and even in self-pity, but something was missing. I had also had the intention of writing down a number of questions to ask Don Juan, Don Janeiro, or even Pablito. The project failed before I had begun. There was something in me that prevented my entering into a mood of inquiry or perplexity. I did not purposely seek to go back to Don Juan and Don Janeiro, but neither did I shy away from the possibility. One day, however, without any premeditation on my part, I simply felt that it was time to see them. In the past, every time I was about to leave for Mexico, I had always had the feeling that there were thousands of important and pressing questions that I wanted to ask Don Juan. This time there was nothing on my mind. It was as if after I had worked over my notes, I had become emptied of the past and ready for the here and now of Don Juan and Don Janeiro's world. I had to wait a few hours before Don Juan found me in the market of a little town in the mountains of central Mexico. He greeted me with the utmost affection and made a casual suggestion. He said that before we arrived at Don Janeiro's place, he would like to pay a visit to Don Janeiro's apprentices, Pablito and Nesta. As I turned off the highway, he told me to keep a close watch for any unusual sight on the side of the road or on the road itself. I asked him to give me more precise clues about what he had in mind. "I can't," he said. "The Nawal doesn't need precise clues." I slowed the car down in an automatic response to his reply. He laughed loudly and signaled me with a movement of his hand to keep on driving. As we approached the town where Pablito and Nesta lived, Don Juan told me to start my car. He moved his chin imperceptibly and pointed to a group of medium-sized boulders on the left side of the road. "There's the Nawal," he said in a whisper. There was no one around. I had expected to see Don Janeiro. I looked at the boulders again, then I scanned the area around them. There was nothing in sight. I strained my eyes to distinguish anything. A small animal, an insect, a shadow, a strange formation of rocks, anything unusual. I gave up after a moment and turned to face Don Juan. He held my questioning gaze without smiling, and then gently pushed my arm with the back of his hand to make me look at the boulders again. I stared at them. Then Don Juan got out of the car and told me to follow him and examine them. We walked slowly on a gentle slope for about 60 or 70 yards to the base of the rocks. He stood there for a moment and whispered in my right ear that the Nawal was waiting for me right at that place. I told him that no matter how hard I tried, all I could distinguish were the rocks and a few tufts of weeds and some cactuses. He insisted, however, that the Nawal was there waiting for me. He ordered me to sit down and turn off my internal dialogue. Then he kept my unfocused eyes on top of the boulders and keep my unfocused eyes on top of the boulders. He sat by me and, putting his mouth to my right ear, whispered that the Nawal had seen me, that it was there although I could not visualize it, and that my problem was merely one of not being capable of completely shutting off my internal dialogue. I heard every word of what he said in a state of inner silence. I understood everything, yet I was incapable of answering. The effort needed to think and talk had been impossible. My reactions to his comments were not thoughts proper, but rather complete units of feeling, which had all the innuendos of meaning that I usually associate with thinking. He whispered that it was very difficult to start by oneself on the path toward the Nawal, and that I was indeed most fortunate to have been launched by the moth and its song. He said that by holding the memory of the moth's call, I could bring it to aid me. His words were either an overpowering suggestion, or perhaps I summoned the perceptual phenomenon he called the moth call. For no sooner had he whispered his words to me than the extraordinary sputtering sound became audible. Its richness of tone made me feel as if I were inside an echo chamber. As the sound grew in loudness or proximity, I also detected in a dreamlike state that something was moving on top of the boulders. The movement frightened me so intensely that I immediately regained my crystal clear awareness. My eyes focused on the boulders. Don Gennaro was sitting on top of one of them. His feet were dangling, and with the heels of his shoes, he was hammering the rock, producing a rhythmical sound that seemed to be synchronized with the moth's call. He smiled and waved his hand at me. I wanted to think rationally. I had the feeling, the desire to figure out how he got there or how I saw him there, but I could not involve my reason at all. All I could do under the circumstances was to look at him while he sat smiling, waving his hands. After a moment, he seemed to get ready to slide down the round boulder. I saw him stiffening his legs, preparing his feet for landing on the hard ground, and arching his back until he almost touched the surface of the rock in order to gain sliding momentum. But in the middle of his descent, his body stopped. I had the impression that he got stuck. He kicked a couple of times with both legs as if he were floating in water. He seemed to be trying to get loose from something that had trapped him by the seat of his pants. He rubbed the sides of his buttocks frantically with both hands. He actually gave me the impression of being painfully caught. I wanted to run to him and aid him, but Don Juan held my arm. I heard him say to me, half choking with laughter, "Watch him, watch him." Don Gennaro kicked, contorted his body, and wiggled from side to side as if he were loosening a nail. Then I heard a loud pop, and he glided or hurled to where Don Juan and I were standing. He landed 4 or 5 feet in front of me on his feet. He rubbed his buttocks and jumped up and down in a dance of pain, yelling profanities. "The rock didn't want to let me go and grabbed me by the ass," he said to me in a sheepish tone. I experienced a sensation of unequaled joy. I laughed loudly. I noticed that my mirth was equal to my clarity of mind. I was engulfed at that moment in an overall state of great awareness. Everything around me was crystal clear. I had been drowsy or absent-minded before because of my inner silence. But then something in Don Juan's sudden appearance had created a state of great lucidity. Don Gennaro kept on rubbing his buttocks and jumping up and down for a while longer. Then he limped to my car, opened the door, and crawled into the back seat. I automatically turned around to talk to Don Juan, but he was not anywhere in sight. I started to call out loud to him. Don Gennaro got out of the car and began to run around in circles, also calling Don Juan's name in a shrill, frantic tone. It was only then, as I watched him, that I realized he was mimicking me. I had an attack of such intense fear upon finding myself alone with Don Gennaro that I had run around the car 3 or 4 times in quite an unconscious manner, yelling Don Juan's name. Don Gennaro said that we had to pick up Pablito and Nesta, and that Don Juan would be waiting for us somewhere along the way. After I had overcome my initial fright, I told him that I was glad to see him. He teased me about my reaction, He said that Don Juan was not like a father to me, but rather like a mother. He made some remarks and puns about mothers that were utterly funny. I was laughing so hard that I did not notice that we had arrived at Pablito's house. Don Gennaro told me to stop and get out of the car. Pablito was standing by the door of his house. He came running and got in the car and sat next to me in the front. "Let's go to Nesta's place," he said, as if he were in a hurry. I turned to look for Don Gennaro. He was not around. We drove up to Nesta's house. He was also waiting by the door. We got out of the car. I had the feeling that the two of them knew what was going on. "Where are we going?" I asked. "Did Gennaro tell you?" Pablito asked me with a tone of incredulity. You know what I mean? I assured them that neither Don Juan nor Don Gennaro had mentioned anything to me. "We're going to a power place," Pablito said. "What are we going to do there?" I asked. They both said in unison that they did not know. Nestor added that Don Gennaro had told them to guide me to the place. "Did you come from Gennaro's house?" Pablito asked. I mentioned that I had been at Don Juan's and that we had found Don Gennaro on the way and that Don Juan had left me with him. "Where did Don Gennaro go?" I asked Pablito. But Pablito did not know what I was talking about. He had not seen Don Gennaro in my car. "He drove with me to your house," I said. "I think you had the narwhal in your car," Nesta said in a frightened tone. "He did not want to sit in the back and cram next to me to Pablito and me and Pablito in the front seat." We drove in silence, except for Nesta's short commands to show the way. I wanted to think about events of that morning, but somehow I knew that any attempt to explain them was a fruitless indulging on my part. I tried to engage Nestor and Pablito in a conversation. They said that they were too nervous inside the car and could not talk. I enjoyed their candid reply and did not press them any further. After more than an hour's drive, we parked the car on a side of the road, and climbed up the side of a steep mountain. We walked in silence for another hour or so, with Nestor in the lead. Then we stopped at the bottom of a huge cliff, which was perhaps over 200 feet high, with a nearly vertical drop. With half-closed eyes, Nesta scanned the ground, looking for a proper place to sit. I was painfully aware that he was clumsy in his scanning movements. Pablito, who was next to me, seemed at various times to be on the verge of stepping in and correcting him, but he restrained himself and relaxed. Then Nesta selected a place. After a moment's hesitation, Pablito sighed with relief. I knew that the place Nesta had selected was the proper one, but I could not figure out how I knew that. Thus, I involved myself in the pseudo-problem of imagining what place I would have selected myself had I been leading them. I could not, however, even begin to speculate on the procedure I would have to follow. Pablito was obviously aware of what I was doing. "You can't do that," he whispered to me. I laughed with embarrassment, as if he had caught me doing something illicit. Pablito laughed and said that Don Gennaro always walked around in the mountains with both of them and gave each one of them the lead from time to time, so we knew that there was no way of imagining what we would have, what would have been one's choice. Gennaro says that the reason why there is no way to do that is because there is only right and wrong choices, he said. If you make a wrong choice, your body knows it, and so does the body of everyone else. But if you make a right choice, the body knows that and relaxes and forgets right away that there was a choice. You loaded your body, see, like a gun for the next choice. If you want to use your body again for making the same choice, it doesn't work. Nesta looked at me. He was apparently curious about my taking notes. He nodded affirmatively, as if agreeing with Pablito, and then smiled for the first time. Two of his upper teeth were crooked. Pablito explained that Nesta was not mean or morbid, but embarrassed by his teeth. And that was the reason he never smiled. Nestor laughed, covering his mouth. I told him that I could send him to a dentist to have his teeth straightened. They thought my suggestion was a joke and laughed like two children. Gennaro says that he has to overcome the feeling of shame by himself, Pablito said, because Gennaro says that he's lucky. While everyone else bites the same way, Nestor can split a bone lengthwise with his strong, crooked teeth, and he can bite a hole through your finger like a nail. Nestor opened his mouth and showed me his teeth. The left incisor and the canine had grown sideways. He made his teeth clatter by biting on them and growling like a dog. He made two or three mock advances towards Pablito, towards me and Pablito. I had never seen Nestor so light. The few times I had been with him in the past, he had given me the impression of being a middle-aged man. As he sat there, smiling with his crooked teeth, I marveled at his youthful appearance. He looked like a young man in his early 20s. Pablito again read my thoughts to perfection. He's losing his self-importance, he said. That's why he's younger. Nestor nodded affirmatively, and without saying a word, he let out a very loud fart. I was startled and dropped my pencil. Pablito and Nestor nearly died laughing. When they had finally calmed down, Nestor came to my side and showed me a homemade contraption that he made that made a peculiar sound when squeezed with the hand. He explained that Don Juan had shown him how to make it. It had a mini bellows, and the vibrator could be any kind of leaf that was placed in a slit between the two pieces of wood that were the compressors. Nestor said that the kind of sound it produced depended on the type of leaf that one used as the vibrator. He wanted me to try it and showed me how to squeeze the compressors to produce a certain kind of sound and how to open them in order to produce another. What do you use it for? I asked. They both exchanged a glance. That's his spirit catcher, you fool, Pablito said cuttingly. His tone was peevish, but his smile was friendly. They were both such strange, unnerving mixture of Don Juan and Don Gennaro. I became absorbed in a horrible thought. Were Don Juan and Don Gennaro playing tricks on me? I had a moment of supreme terror, but something snapped inside my stomach, and I instantly became calm again. I knew that Pablito and Nestor were using Don Gennaro and Don Juan as models for their behavior. I myself had found that I also was behaving more and more like them. Pablito said that Nestor was lucky to have a spirit catcher and that he did not have one himself. What shall we do there? I asked Pablito. Nestor answered as if I had addressed the question to him. Gennaro told me that we have to wait there, and while we wait, we should laugh and enjoy ourselves, he said. How long do you think we have to wait? I asked. He did not answer. He shook his head and looked at Pablito as if asking him. I have no idea, Pablito said. We got involved then in a lively conversation about Pablito's sisters. Nestor teased him that his oldest sister had such a mean look that she could kill lice with her eyes. He said that Pablito was afraid of her because she was so strong that once, in a fit of anger, she plucked a handful of hair as if it were chicken feathers. Pablito conceded that his oldest sister had been a beast, but that the Nawal had fixed her and brought her into line. After he had told me the story of how she was made to behave, I realized that Pablito and Nestor never mentioned Don Juan's name, but referred to him as the Nawal. Apparently, Don Juan had intervened in Pablito's life and coerced all his sisters into leading a more harmonious life. Pablito said that after the Nawal was through with them, they were like saints. Nestor wanted to know what I did with my notes. I explained my work to them. I had the weird sensation that they were generally interested in what I was saying, and I ended up talking about anthropology and philosophy. I felt ludicrous and wanted to stop, but I found myself immersed in my elucidation and unable to cut it short. I had the unsettling sensation that both of them as a team were somehow forcing me into that lengthy explanation. Their eyes were fixed on me. They did not seem to be bored or tired. I was in the middle of a comment when I heard a faint sound, when I heard the faint sound of the moth's call. My body stiffened, and I never finished my sentence. "The narwhal is here," I said automatically. Nestor and Pablito exchanged a look that I thought was sheer terror and jumped to my side and flanked me. Their mouths were open. They looked like frightened children. I had the inconceivable sensory experience then. My left ear began to move. I felt it sort of wiggle by itself. It practically turned my head in half a circle until I was facing what I thought was the east. My head tilted slightly to the right, in that position I was capable of detecting the rich sputtering sound of the moth's call. It sounded as if it were far away, coming from the northeast. Once I had established the direction, my ear picked up an incredible amount of sound. I had no way of knowing, however, whether they were memories of sounds I had heard before or actual sounds that were being produced. The place where we were was rugged west slope of a mountain range. Towards the northeast, there was groves of trees and patches of mountain shrubs. My ear seemed to pick up the sound of something heavy moving over rocks coming from that direction. Nesta and Pablito were either responding to my actions or they themselves were hearing the same sounds. I would have liked to ask them, but I did not dare, or perhaps I was incapable of interrupting my concentration. Nesta and Pablito huddled against me, by my sides. When the sound became louder and closer, Nesta seemed to be the one who was most affected by it. His body shivered uncontrollably. At one moment, my left arm began to shake. It raised without my volition until it was almost level with my face. Then it pointed to an area of shrubs. I heard a vibratory sound or a roar. It was a familiar sound to me. I had heard it many years before under the influence of a psychotropic plant. I detected in the shrubs a gigantic black shape. It was as if the shrubs themselves were becoming darker by degrees until they had changed into an ominous blackness. I had no definitive form. It had no definitive form, but it moved. It seemed to breathe. I heard a chilling scream, which was mixed with the yells of terror of Pablito and Nesta, and the shrubs or the black shape into which they had turned flew up towards us. I could not maintain my equanimity. Somehow, something in me faltered. The shape first hovered over us and then engulfed us. The light around us became opaque. It was as if the sun had set, or as if all of a sudden it had become twilight. I felt Nestor and Pablito's heads under my armpits. I brought my arms down over their heads and in an unconscious protective movement, and I fell spinning backwards. I did not reach the rocky ground, however. For an instant later, I found myself standing up, flanked by Pablito and Nesta. Both of them, although taller than I, seemed to have shriveled by arching their legs and backs. They were actually shorter than I and fit under my arms. Don Juan and Don Gennaro were standing in front of us. Don Gennaro's eyes glittered like the eyes of a cat at night. Don Juan's eyes had the same glow. I had never seen Don Juan look that way. He was truly awesome, more so than Don Gennaro. He seemed younger and stronger than usual, looking at both of them. I had the maddening feeling they were not men like myself. Pablito and Nesta whined quietly. Then John Don Gennaro said that we were the picture of the Trinity. I was the Father, Pablito the Son, and Nestor the Holy Ghost. Don Juan and Don Gennaro laughed in a booming voice. Pablito and Nestor smiled meekly. Don Gennaro said that we had to disentangle ourselves because embraces were permissible only between men and women, or between a man and his burrow. I realized then that I was standing on the same spot I had been before, and that obviously I had not spun backwards as I had thought I had. In fact, Nestor and Pablito were also in the same spot they had been on. Don Gennaro signaled Pablito and Nestor with a movement of his hand. Don Juan signaled me to follow them. Nestor took the lead and pointed out a sitting place for me and another one for Pablito. We sat in a straight line about 50 yards from the place where Don Juan and Don Gennaro stood motionless at the base of the cliff. As I kept on staring at them, my eyes went involuntarily out of focus. I knew I had definitely crossed them because I was seeing four of them. Then my left eye image of Don Juan became superimposed on the right eye image of Don Gennaro, and the result of the merger was that I saw the iridescent being standing in between Don Juan and Don Gennaro. It was not a man, or as I ordinarily see a man. It was rather a ball of white fire, something like filters or a white cupboard. I shook my head. The double image was dispelled, and yet the sight of Don Juan and Don Gennaro as luminous beings persisted. I was seeing two strange, elongated, luminous objects. They looked like white, incandescent footballs with fibers that had a light of their own. The two luminous beings shriveled. I actually saw their fibers shrinking, and then they whizzed out of sight. They were pulled up by a long filament, a cobweb that seemed to shoot out from the top of the cliff. The sensation I had was that a long beam of light or a luminous line had dropped from the rock and lifted them up. I perceived the sequence with my eyes and with my body. I was also capable of noticing enormous disparities in my mode of perceiving. I was incapable of speculating about them as I would ordinarily have done. Thus, I was aware that I was looking straight at the base of the cliff, and yet I was seeing Don Juan and Don Gennaro on top as if I had tilted my head up 45 degrees. I wanted to feel afraid, or perhaps to cover my face and weep, or do something else within my normal range of responses, but I seemed to be locked. My desires were not thoughts, as I know thoughts. Therefore, they could not evoke the emotional response I was accustomed to eliciting in myself. Don Juan and Don Gennaro plunged to the ground. I felt that they had done so, judging by the consuming feeling of falling that I experienced in my stomach. Don Gennaro remained where he had landed, but Don Juan walked towards us and sat down behind me, to my right. Nestor was in a crouching position, his legs tucked in against his stomach. He was resting his chin on his cupped palms. His forearms served as support by being propped up against his thighs. Pablito was sitting with his body slightly bent forward, holding his hand against his stomach. I noticed then that I had placed my forearms across my umbilical region, and I was holding myself by the skin on my sides. I had grabbed myself so hard that my sides ached. Don Juan spoke in a dry murmur, addressing all of us. "You must fix your gaze on the Nahual," he said. All thoughts and words must be washed away. He repeated it 4 or 5 times. His voice was strange, unknown to me. It gave me the actual feeling of the scales on the skin of a lizard. The simile was a feeling, not a conscious thought. Each of his words peeled like scales. There was such an eerie rhythm to them. They were muffled, dry, like soft coughing. A rhythmical murmur that made it into a command. Don Gennaro stood motionless. As I stared at him, I could not keep my image conversion, and my eyes crossed involuntarily. In that state, I noticed again a strange luminosity in Don Gennaro's body. My eyes were beginning to close or to tear. Don Juan came to my rescue. I heard him giving me a command not to cross my eyes. I felt a small tap on my head. He had apparently hit me with the pebble. I saw the pebble bounce a couple of times on the rocks near me. He must have also hit Nestor and Pablito. I heard the sound of the other pebbles as they bounced on the rocks. Don Gennaro adopted a strange dancing posture. His knees were bent. His arms were extended at each side, his fingers outstretched. He seemed to be about to twirl. In fact, he half whirled around, and then he was pulled up. I had the clear perception that he had been hoisted by the line of a great caterpillar that lifted his body to the very top of the cliff. My perception of the upward movement was a most weird mixture of visual and bodily sensation. I half saw and half felt his flight to the top. There was something that looked or felt like a line or an almost imperceptible thread of light pulling him up. I did not see the flight upwards in the sense that I would allow a bird in flight with my eyes. There was no linear sequence of his movement. I did not have to raise my hand to keep him within my field of vision. I saw the line pulling him, and then I felt his movement with my body, or with my body. And then the next instant, he was on the very top of the cliff, hundreds of feet up. After a few moments, he plummeted down. I felt his falling and groaning involuntarily. Don Gennaro repeated his feat 3 more times. Each time, my perception was turned. During his last upward leap, I could actually distinguish a series of lines emanating from his midsection. I knew when he was about to ascend or descend, judging by the way the lines moved. When he was about to leap upward, the lines bent upward. The opposite happened when he was about to leap downward. The lines bent outward and down. After his fourth leap, Don Gennaro came to us and sat down behind Pablito and Nesta. Then Don Juan moved to the front and stood where Don Gennaro had been. He sat motionless for a while. Don Gennaro gave some brief instructions to Pablito and Nesta. I did not understand what he had said. I glanced at them and saw that he made each one hold a rock and place it against the area of their navels. I was wondering whether I had to do that when he told me that the precaution did not apply to me, but nonetheless, I should have a rock within reach just in case I got ill. Don Gennaro jutted his chin forward to indicate that I should gaze at Don Juan, and then he said something unintelligible. He repeated it, and although I did not understand his words, I knew that it was more or less the same formula that Don Juan had voiced. The words did not really matter. It was the rhythm and the dryness of tone, the cough-like quality. I had the certainty that whatever language Don Gennaro was using was more appropriate than Spanish for the staccato quality of the rhythm. Don Juan did exactly as Don Gennaro had initially done, but then instead of leaping upward, he twirled around like a gymnast. In a semi-aware way, I expected him to land on his feet again. He never did. His body kept on twirling a few feet above the ground. Then circles were very rapid at first, then slowed down. From where I was, I could see Don Juan's body hanging like Don Gennaro's body had, from a thread-like light. He whirled around slowly, as if it allowed us the full view, Then he began to ascend. He gained altitude until he reached the top of the cliff. Don Juan was actually floating as if he had no weight. His turns were slow and he evoked the image of an astronaut in space whirling around in a state of weightlessness. I got dizzy as I watched him. My feelings of getting ill seemed to trigger him, and he began to whirl at a greater speed. He moved away from the cliff as if he gained speed. I became utterly sick. I grabbed the rock and placed it on my stomach. I pressed it against my body as hard as I could. Its touch soothed me a bit. The act of reaching for the rock and holding it against me had allowed me a moment's break, although I had not taken my eyes away from Don Juan. I had nevertheless broken my concentration. Before I reached for the rock, I felt the speed which his floating body had gained was blurring his shape and looked like a rotating disc and then a light that was spinning. After I had placed the rock against my body, his speed diminished. He looked like a hat floating in the air, a kite that bobbed back and forth. The movement of the kite was even more unsettling. I became uncontrollably ill. I heard the flapping of bird wings, and after a moment of uncertainty, I knew that the events had ended. I felt so ill and exhausted that I lay down to sleep. I must have dozed off for a while. I opened my eyes when someone shook my arm. It was Pablito. He spoke to me in a frantic tone and said that I could not fall asleep because if I did, all of us would die. He insisted that we had to leave right away, or even if we had to drag ourselves on all fours. He also seemed to be physically exhausted. In fact, I had the idea that we should spend the night there. The prospect of walking to my car in the dark seemed most dreadful to me. I tried to convince Pablito, who was getting more frantic. Nesta was so ill, that he was indifferent. Pablito sat down in a state of total despair. I made an effort to organize my thoughts. It was quite dark by then, although there was still enough light to distinguish the rocks around us. The quietness was exquisite and soothing. I enjoyed the moment fully, and suddenly my body jumped. I heard the distant sound of a branch being cracked. I automatically turned to Pablito. He seemed to know what had happened to me. We grabbed Nesta by the armpits and practically lifted him up. We dragged him and ran. He apparently was the only one who knew the way. He gave us short commands from time to time. I was not concerned with what we did. My attention was focused on my left ear, which seemed to be a unit independent from the rest of me. Some feeling in me forced me to stop every so often and scan the surroundings with my ear. I knew something was following us. It was something massive. It crushed small rocks as it advanced. Nesta regained a degree of composure and walked by himself, holding on to Pablito's arm occasionally. We arrived at a group of trees, but then it was completely dark. I heard a sudden and extremely loud cracking sound. It was like the cracking of a monstrous whip that lashed the tops of the trees. I could feel a wave of some sort rippling overhead. Pablito and Nesta screamed and scrambled out of there at full speed. I wanted them to stop. I was not sure I could run in the dark. But at that instant, I heard and felt a series of heavy exhalations right behind me. My fright was indescribable. The three of us ran together until we reached the car. Nesta led us in some unknown way. I thought that I should leave them at their business, at their houses, and then go to a hotel in town. I would not have gone to Gennaro's place for anything in the world, but Nesta did not want to leave the car. Neither did Pablito, and neither did I. We ended up at Pablito's house. He sent Nesta to buy some beer and cola, while his mother and sisters prepared food for us. Nesta made a joke and asked if we could be escorted by the older sister in case he was attacked by dogs or drunkards. Pablito laughed and said and told me that he had been entrusted with Nesta. "Who has entrusted you with him?" I asked. "Power, of course," he replied. "At one time, Nesta was older than me. Then Gennaro did something to him, and now he's younger. You saw that, didn't you?" "What did Gennaro do?" I asked him. "You know, he made him a child again. He was too important and heavy. He would have died if he was not turned younger." There was something truly candid and endearing about Pablito. The simplicity of his explanation was so overwhelming to me. Nesta was indeed younger. Not only did he look younger, but he acted like an innocent child. I knew without any doubt that he genuinely felt like one. "I take care of him," Pablito continued. "Gennaro says that it's an honor to look after a warrior. Nesta is a fine warrior." His eyes shone like Don Gennaro's. He patted me vigorously on the back and laughed. "Wish him well, Carlitos," he said. "Wish him well." I was very tired. I had a strange surge of happy sadness. I told him that I came from a place where people rarely, if ever, wished one another well. "I know," he said, "the same thing happened to me. But I am a warrior now, and I can afford to wish him well." End of chapter.